This is CliffCentral.com.
Hello and welcome to this podcast. I am Gary Hertzberg. Today we are discussing subjects that most employers grapple with, and those are, firstly, how without falling foul of the law can you fire a non-performing, possibly lazy, and maybe useless staff member? And secondly, how can you dismiss that office idiot who spends half his work life away from the office, sick? Now, the law on this one is really very tricky, and one wrong move could find you in the CCMA getting your ass kicked. For this series, multinational law firm Evershed Sutherland will be joining me in studio. Today we are joined by attorneys from their Santon office. First up, ladies first, Nadia Froneman. She's an LLB graduate from Rhodes with a cum laude. She's a senior associate at Evershed Sutherland, specializing in employment law. And joining her from the same firm, Tasso Anastidis. He's a senior associate at Evershed Sutherland, as well specializing in employment law. Welcome to you all. Our partner today is Legal Talk South Africa, and they have 226,000 Facebook members and growing continually. And they pin our show on top of their page for their members to download as a podcast. So we appreciate that very much. Guys, let's talk about the concept of poor performance. It's a serious, serious problem for employers, particularly managers, that find an employee is not performing and they want to kick him out. They want him out, but they're not quite sure how. Firstly, Nadia, how do they do this? Maybe you want to tell us give us an example of poor performance, or whichever way you want to deal with it.
Thank you, Gary. Well, Gary, it really depends when assessing whether an employee is performing poorly. It really depends what is the job that they're employed to do. So the nature of the job becomes very important. For example, you could have a sales rep who's simply not meeting his performance targets. You could have a teacher whose pass rate is perhaps not very good. So you need to look at what is the performance criteria. Are they failing to meet that? And then you can take action. The task of dismissing someone for poor performance is quite tedious, Gary. It is a long and arduous process. It involves the employer jumping through lots of hoops. So it is important that employers know at the outset what they must do when they are faced with a poor performer, because it's always best to nip these things in the bud and to deal with it, as opposed to ignoring the poor performance, letting other employees carry the weight, because that also creates a lot of dissatisfaction in the workplace for your good performers.
So let's take you've given us two examples. You said there's a sales rep who doesn't make his target. We're going to deal with that in more detail, because that's one that you can easily show. We asked him to sell X, he sold X minus, he's not performing.
Correct.
The other one you mentioned was
a teacher, for
a
example.
A teacher is not, yeah. Let's talk about a person within the office environment. Okay, he's lazy. You ask him to do stuff, it doesn't get done when you ask. It's just generally he dishes up shoddy work. Mm-hmm. He's a poor performer in my view. Is he a poor performer, or is he guilty of misconduct? Which of those applies to him?
That's an excellent question, Gary, and this is what lots of employers are faced with. So our courts have developed a very interesting test to determine whether a matter falls within the realm of incapacity for poor work performance or misconduct. And how they describe that test is they ask the questions, can an employee perform the task, but they simply do not? That is a case of misconduct. Or does the employee try but simply cannot? And that would fall within the realm of poor performance. So when you speak about your lazy employee who simply produces shoddy work, who has a lot of grammatical or spelling errors in their work, if that employee has previously demonstrated that they can you know, present an immaculate piece of work, and 6 months down the line, suddenly they're giving you know, work with spelling mistakes and grammatical errors, then you can treat that matter as a matter of misconduct. But when an employee at the outset of the relationship demonstrates that they are unable to reach the required performance standard, then you're dealing with a poorly performing employee, and then the employer's got a long road ahead of it in terms of dealing with that poor performer, trying to assist that poor performer in reaching the performance standards. And if the assisting mechanisms, which we'll obviously delve into in more detail later on, if those are unsuccessful, then the employer can embark upon the process to having that employee dismissed.
Is it the concept of poor performance a subjective or objective one? In other words, is it me, the employer, who sees him as performing poorly, or would the reasonable man, anyone, see him performing poorly? And that's a problem, because the employee says, but I'm doing great. It's you who expects too much from me. Mm. What do you want from me? Tussle, how do we deal with that?
Yes, and again, Gary, that is an excellent question. And right at the outset, I think it's important to emphasize that the measures and the standards must be set. In other words, if the employee does not know what's expected of them, then the whole process is doomed for failure. So right at the beginning, you know, and this is often done in the employment contract itself or a specific job description. So right at the outset, make sure that as the employer, you have made the employees aware of what is expected of them. You know, and that's crucial, and that must be done right at the outset, because without that, the process is deemed to fail. And then once that's done, you can see that the process becomes more objective, because and there is an element of subjectivity, but you want to try and make it as fair and as objective as possible. So you get a written document clearly and expressly setting out what is required of the employee.
I go to a restaurant, there are 10 waiters. 5 of them are terrific. They run. You ask them for something, it's there. The bill comes on time. Your glass of water's there. They're terrific. There's another 5 that are slow. They're performing, in my view as a customer, poorly. Is that poor performance, or are the others just performing very, very well?
No, that's a clear case of poor performance. And in that scenario, they should be, and they would ordinarily be, well aware of what's expected of them. And
how do you kick that weight in the ass who's not there immediately when you want your glass of water? What do you do with
them? Well, you must start a process. Yep. So what you cannot do, unfortunately, is just dismiss them on the spot, there and then. Mm. Our law guards against that. Mm. You must initiate and start a process. But as Nadia referred to the test, determine whether those waiters can do the job, but they're just messing about, you know, in the back and not actually doing their job, because then you may want to follow a misconduct route. But if the 5 waiters in your example are trying, are absolutely, you know, doing their best, but they're struggling with remembering the orders, or they're just not quick enough, start a process. You know, get them down, document it, record it, say, this is what we expect of you, this is where you're falling short, and we need to give you a bit of time to meet the required standard. Also in that example, the problem that employers will face, Gary, is when the employees are client-facing, you know, it's a bit more alarming to the employer, because now they're potentially losing business. Mm. The damage to the employer is potentially great. So you want to act quickly and efficiently. And when there's a client-facing employee, you can, due to the potential harm and reputational damage, expedite the process. And if there's no improvement, move towards a hearing. You still need to have an incapacity hearing and potentially dismiss.
Okay, you mentioned that we've got to try and upskill these people that we perceive to be performing poorly.
Yes.
What is there? Must I train them more? What must I do with it?
So it also really depends on the nature of the job. Mm. So in your waiter example, you could send them on a course to upskill their abilities, or you could, you know, do particular speed tests, which you could do, you know, every 2 weeks, for example, and after you've given them whatever training is necessary, and our law isn't prescriptive on the training, it really depends on the nature of the job. once you have given them that training, then you need to assess them again to see whether that has assisted them in reaching the required performance standard.
Am I compelled as an employer, when I perceive someone to be performing poorly, am I obliged to send him for training, counseling, support, all those kind of things before I do what with him?
Okay.
I want to get rid of him. He's poor. He's performing poorly. I can't. I've got to send him for those courses. Am I right?
Yes. So there's no obligation on the employer to expend any money in training the employee or in upskilling them. Mm-hmm. The onus is a bit bigger when, for example, an employer hires an employee who they know is a bit underskilled for the role which they're hiring. And we see this often happening in workplaces where, you know, it might be a bit cheaper for an employer to hire someone who doesn't necessarily have the correct qualifications. And then what they do is they make a determined condition of employment for that employee to obtain that qualification within a certain period of time. That employer will find it very difficult to dismiss that particular employee if they have not met the required performance standards, particularly if they give them a very short period of time within which to reach that. But to go back to your question, Gary, is there an obligation to provide assistance? Mm. Yes, there is. Often what employers do is they just provide mechanisms such as on-the-job training or intensive supervision for a period of time, depending on the role. So there's no obligation to expend any money. And it is an onerous process, and it is very time-consuming, especially for managers.
What happens if that employee is just not cut out for the job? He's just not, he doesn't deserve to be a waiter or a technician, a car mechanic, whatever it is. How do I dispense with him?
Okay.
Tasso, Nadia, whoever.
Tasso, yeah. You take it away.
Yeah, so your question is alluding to an element of incompatibility. Mm-hmm. But incompatibility is a bit more difficult and a little bit more onerous, whereas this is the reason why poor work performance falls under incapacity. So it's also referred to as a no-fault dismissal, in that misconduct is your fault. Mm-hmm. Whereas we're not saying you're at fault. We're just saying you're incapacitated to perform the job. So you're not fit for the role. You're not equipped to perform.
You're just not cut out to do
this. Do I have to find him another job within the company? No.
Of course it doesn't hurt, and there's no harm in trying to do that. I mean, you know, our law does try to protect employees and their employment. So there's no harm in doing that.
If he's just incapable, do I have a hearing? How do I dismiss this person?
I'll get to that question, Gary. The other thing I just wanted to add is you've also got to assess what level of employee are you dealing with.
Yes.
You know, with your previous example, you were referring to waiters. But what about the CEO of a company?
Right.
Now, the CEO of a company, you're not going to send to a course. Mm. And when particular employees warrant a particular skill or a particular knowledge, there is less obligations on the employer to upskill and train.
Mm-hmm.
Can I give another example of a heart surgeon? Mm. You know, you don't need to tell the heart surgeon how to do their job. But if they mess up during a heart surgery, you know, you can move very quickly to a hearing and dismissal, mm-hmm. because that's very different to your waiter. Mm-hmm. So look, assess the seniority of the employee. Do they warrant special skills and special knowledge of the job?
And just to add on to Taz's point, our law provides that a very senior employee is expected to be able to judge themselves. So if I can see that I'm not meeting a particular performance standard within my role as a very senior employee, I'm expected then to go out and upskill myself in order that I can reach that particular performance standard. It's not for the employer to come and tell me as the CEO of a company, look, Nadia, you're not cutting it. We think you should do X, Y, and Z. Mm. I should be able to monitor my own performance and to take that initiative.
I actually have an example of a recent case that we did and won, where we had an employee that was employed as the director of maintenance for a campus of a university. Mm. Now, that's a very senior role. Mm. And, you know, the university noticed that the state of the campus was looking a bit dingy and wasn't looking great, and they went directly to him, and they found out he wasn't doing his job. Mm. We didn't upskill him. We didn't train him. We quickly moved to a hearing and dismissed him, and that dismissal was upheld in court.
On what grounds did you dismiss him?
On poor performance. Mm. He was just not performing, and we didn't have to – he was trying, but we didn't have to upskill him. We didn't have to train him. Mm.
In other words, he should have known in that position what his obligations were.
Yeah, he can't claim ignorance or lack of knowledge.
And what the court considered quite intently in that matter is that this employee was a director, and he was paid handsomely for that role, yet he wasn't meeting the required performance standard. So because of his seniority and the fact that he was remunerated so handsomely, the court said, you know, he should have been able to perform. He warranted that he could, and he simply wasn't, and we were therefore justified in dismissing him.
A point that always comes up in the many shows I've done is probationary employees.
Yes.
First of all, what is a probationary employee? Are you allowed to take someone on, firstly, on probation? For how long? Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with him if he doesn't perform?
Mm-hmm. So what lots of employers do is they employ someone on a probationary period. The length of the probationary period is really determinative in regard to the role. So, for example, you might put a CEO on a probation period for 12 months. That might seem like a long period of time, but if the CEO is coming into a company which perhaps requires a lot of work, you know, that time is reasonable to assess whether that employee is suitable for the role. So you need to look at the purpose of the probation period, and the purpose is to give the employer an opportunity to assess that employee's capabilities and to determine whether their appointment should be confirmed. So the question is whether probationary employees must be treated any differently, and the simple answer is no. Mm-hmm. Now you would question why is this the case? Because I can do this to assess their performance. Why can't I simply just not confirm their appointment? And the reason is that our law provides that even probationary employees should be protected by our employment laws, which means that if they are dismissed, they must be dismissed for a fair reason and pertinent to a fair procedure. Now, there is a silver lining for employers in this case, and that is that our courts say that when assessing whether the dismissal of a probationary employee was fair, they can consider factors which are less compelling than if that employee had been permanently confirmed. Mm-hmm. So the substantive element, the threshold in that regard is lowered somewhat in the case of probationary employees. But you still need to go through the procedure which Tassa was talking about. You still need to jump through those hoops of giving them some training, some guidance, some mentoring. You still need to assess them after that period, give them a reasonable opportunity to improve, assess them, and if they are still not performing, then you can call them to a hearing and present those reasons which are maybe less compelling.
At the beginning of the show, I think you spoke about the salesperson who's been given a sales target. I think we've got to deal with that. So I, as the boss of the company, tell my new salesperson, I expect you to sell so many bottles of jam a week or a month, and he doesn't. Is that poor work performance? He says, well, hold on a second. I just can't. The market is too poor for that.
Well, you need to investigate why. Why is the employee not performing? Why is he not selling the jam? Mm. There may be a valid reason for that. In other words, he doesn't have access to a computer or a laptop which enables him to email customers and get orders out.
Yeah.
So that's where, you know, an investigation must be done. You can't just go, you haven't met your target, pack your bags, cheers, you're gone. Investigate. There might be a valid reason.
Okay, well, the employee says, I've got all the computers and all the rest. What I don't have is I don't have enough customers. I just cannot meet that sales target. I just cannot do it. And now you want to fire me on a poor work performance. I think your sales target is too high. You must lower it. And that's the discussion you would have with your employer.
Yes,
as an employer.
But you can look at other factors, as in what are the other sales, what are the targets of the other salesperson, what is the employee that was before you, what were their targets. So you must set a reasonable standard. You know, Gary, you are touching on something important, because if you set an unreasonable and unattainable target, and if you eventually dismiss that employee, that dismissal might be deemed unfair, because the targets were unattainable, were unreasonable. So they must be reasonable, and the employee must be able to demonstrate that they are reasonable and attainable, and that the employee ought to have achieved those targets.
I recall about 2 years ago here on Cliff Central, I interviewed a man called Parkinson.
Yes.
He was employed by Damlin. And they set a target. They said, we want so many new pupils per year.
Yeah.
And he couldn't make it. And that case landed up in the labor courts, the CCMA first and so on. I think it went to the Labor Appeal Court. What do you remember the upshot of the legal side on that one?
Yes, Gary. So what had happened in that case is that the employee had been given a written warning in respect of not meeting certain targets. There was a long history to the matter, but the nub of it was that after that warning was issued, he was given another target, and he was meant to enroll a certain amount of students. I can't remember the number right now, but he was meant to enroll that certain number in 27 days. And what the court said was, look, that's a very short period of time within which to assess whether the employee has met that standard, and also, you know, it's a very big task, mm-hmm. Which was put on him to achieve within that limited time period, and his dismissal was upheld to have been unfair.
There you go. So one's got to be, it's all a question of fairness. Isn't that really what it is? You've got to be fair with your employee.
Always, Gary, and especially he's got to, in labor law.
Absolutely. I think we learned that. Before we move on to the incapacity ill health section, is there anything on poor performance that you'd like to mention to me, Tasso?
I think we just have some general tips to the average HR manager out there. And start with getting a policy in place. Mm. Get a poor performance policy in place. And a tip from us.
Do you draft that for clients?
We specialize in drafting that, and we do that routinely. Mm-hmm. Through experience, what we've realized is that sometimes employers set themselves too onerous a task. Mm. They provide themselves too many hurdles and loops to jump through themselves.
Yeah.
And this is a common mistake which employers do, or the persons that draft the policies for employees. Mm. Don't make it overly technical. Mm. Don't make your own lives more difficult than they have to be. Follow the law, but don't bend over too backwards for the employees. You know, be fair. So yes, I think that's the greatest tip I can say for now is for the HR managers, get a policy in place. Mm. And then where possible, make sure your employees have job descriptions. You know, and often you hear the term job description, but it's not actually, you'll be surprised how many employees don't have job descriptions. Mm. So I'd make sure, you know, for the HR managers out there, check your employees and make sure they have job descriptions, and also that they are, they've been disclosed or provided to the employees themselves. There's no use having it and not giving it to the employee. So I think, you know, going forward for the HR manager out there, do those two things.
Mm, good
and
advice.
That, and
excellent.
That will help you, you know, down the line.
And excellent. Just to add to what Tussle said, document. Mm. Document everything. When you can see that an employee is a potential poor performer, start documenting the process from the outset. Even if it's, you know, menial instructions via email, document every conversation that you've had where you've offered them guidance, where you've offered them on the job training, because those documents are going to be critical when that employee takes the employer to the CCMA.
Yeah. Offhand, can you record a telephone conversation you have with your employer if you're the employee, or vice versa? Can you record that discussion?
You can technically
a telephone discussion or a meeting. At a meeting, can you record the meeting?
What the law prescribes is, as long as you are a party to the conversation, you can record it. Mm. You know, and that's in terms of the RICA Act. So yes, you can. Mm. You know, when I do advise clients on this, I say, By all means, and legally you can record it, but in some scenarios it may just be ethical of you to disclose that you're recording it. And you know, sometimes when an employer is looking at a poor performing employee, there's nothing wrong with saying, I am recording this. Mm. You know, that's not threatening or untoward in any way, and the employer legally has every right to do so.
Experience tells me when you tip them off, then they become wary and then they don't talk and they're scared.
True.
So if you really want to get something on the record, the law doesn't say that you have to notify the employee employer.
You're legally entitled.
And morally and ethically, you're absolutely right. You should tip them off. It's your decision.
But it does influence the conversation.
It will definitely influence it. If you're telling me you're recording me as we are now, I've got to be very circumspect in what I say.
Yes
Gary. And also just to add to that, you know, an employer must always assume that the employee is in fact recording them. Because employees often take clandestine recordings without, you know, telling the employer themselves.
Your cell phone is a recording machine. Yeah.
Exactly. So always assume that you are being recorded as an employer when having any of these difficult conversations.
Yeah. The case with the sales target was Damlin versus Solidarity on behalf of Parkinson. If you go on Google, you'll find it. It's a 2017 case. If you're an HR person or whoever and you're listening to this, have a look at that case on poor performance sales targets. Excellent case. Now, there's something I want to talk to you lawyers about. I'm also a lawyer, but we learn from one another. Research is indicating that on any one day in South Africa, 15%, 1/5, of our workforce is absent. 15%. Mm. Now, obviously, the cost in terms of lost production and morale and discipline is huge. What's going on out there? This is crazy. We're confronted with these employees who are constantly taking off time. How do we deal with it?
Yes, Gary. Again, this is another form of incapacity. So it falls under that general umbrella. It just, instead of poor performance, you've got medical incapacity.
Mm.
And our law does recognize that an employer can terminate an employee's employment for medical incapacity. But yet again, there are some hurdles and hoops we have to jump through.
Sorry, Tasso. How much sick leave do I take before I have to produce a medical certificate?
So that is prescribed in terms of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act.
Yeah.
And the section states it's 2 consecutive days,
yes,
or 2 days within an 8-week period. And what the section technically says is that an employer may refuse paying that person their salary for those days if they don't provide proof of the incapacity.
You know, I've often found this quite astounding. The poor employee is really laid up in bed. How does he go to a doctor and get a certificate? I mean, it's crazy when you think about it.
Yeah.
That's the law.
But
you know, it's quite difficult to obtain, isn't it? If you're lying in bed for 2 days and you really just can't get out of bed.
Correct. That's a practical difficulty. But I mean, once you're better, you can try go. Or there's ways that an employee must get it. But unfortunately, that's for the employee to sort out, Gary. And
there's just one question. What about a clinic? The closest, there's no doctor in the area. We're in a rural area. We bring a clinic certificate of attendance.
So what our law requires is the certificate must be from a valid medical practitioner.
Mm.
So it doesn't, because sometimes you get these one-man shows, these doctors that have their own offices.
Mm.
That is valid. Mm. So it's not so much whether it comes from a hospital or a clinic, but who is the medical practitioner?
Mm.
Is that medical practitioner registered with a council?
Well, it's generally a nurse at a clinic. Some clinic in a rural area.
No, that may not be acceptable.
That's
not acceptable in terms of our law.
Mm. Nadia?
Just to speak on your practical difficulty regarding, you know, the sick employee who's in his bed for 2 days straight.
Mm.
You know, on many of these medical certificates, there's actually a pre-printed on the medical certificate which says that I saw this patient on X date, or I was advised that the patient was ill on X date. So there is an option on those medical certificates for the medical practitioner to indicate that, you know, Gary advised me that he was in bed ill for 2 days. So you know, and it's important that the medical practitioner must actually disclose that, to say, you know, I actually didn't see Gary on the first day that he was ill. I saw him on the third day when he was actually better. Mm. You know, and to be upfront about that. And medical practitioners, in our experience, are quite upfront about that. They won't say, you know, Gary was 100% ill on day one, when they don't, they have got no knowledge of that. They didn't see you on day one.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Mm. Okay. Now, talk to us about what we call a malingering employee. What is that?
So, Gary, that's your typical employee who is often sick on a Friday or sick on a Monday, and you know, the sense is, you know, he's quite the jolla, so he goes out on a Friday. He might have gotten in home late from Thirsty Thursday, and he's also, you know, just too hungover to come to work on Monday because he's had a bender the whole long weekend. It's also, you know, we often find it with admin staff where, you know, they think it's an entitlement. Sick leave is an entitlement. So if I've got 30 days in a three-year period, you know, I've got like 1.5 days a month that I'm entitled to take. You know, sick leave isn't there for the taking. It's there when you are genuinely sick. Mm-hmm. So you can't just take your sick leave because you think that it's an entitlement. So that's your malingering employee. And when it comes to those types of employees, it's important to investigate the pattern. So pull their sick leave records, check when they are ordinarily absent, and if you can see a pattern, you know, address that with the employee. Interrogate their medical certificates. And while our law provides that you are only required to submit a sick note when you're absent for 2 consecutive days or in 2 days in an 8-week period, we suggest and in fact recommend to many of our clients that you should have a sick leave policy which actually takes it a bit further and says, you know, if you're absent on a Friday or a Monday or a day before or after a public holiday, you must submit a sick note, even before your line manager asks you to do so. You know, it's the default position. So, you know, you can take steps like that in order to prevent malingering employees.
That's good advice. Yeah. Excellent.
And also, Gary, you know, we also often tell our clients, you should do a return to work interview with your employees once they've come back from a period of sick leave. So even if it's one day, so you just call the employee in and you say, look, Gary, we noticed you were absent yesterday. What's the story? Are you better? Is there something we can assist you with? And those types of return to work interviews can act as a deterrent for employees, because if you are, you know, just taking advantage of the system, you know, that might, those return to work interviews might dissuade you from just taking leave because you can.
Mm. Tassel, depressed. This is so common. It's the common cold of mental diseases is depression. People are suffering from depression, genuinely or not genuinely. How do you deal with that from a sick leave point of view?
But you've hit the nail on the head with your question, Gary. Is it genuine or not? Yeah. You know, has the employee been formally diagnosed with depression by a psychiatrist? You know, a psychologist might not be good enough, because a psychiatrist is more of a medically qualified doctor to diagnose an employee with depression. So interrogate it. You know, don't just accept it at face value and the employee tells you he's depressed because, you know, his girlfriend broke up with him. Mm. That's not good enough.
It's enough to make you depressed.
So interrogate it. You know, get a medical opinion. Also, what I found through experience,
I think the word depression is taken too commonly. You know, we all say, I'm depressed today, but that's not clinical depression.
Exactly.
Clinical depression is something completely different, and that's when this kicks in, that you're entitled to leave, sick leave.
Yes.
But for normal, just, you know, average depression, you know, come to work. We're all feeling depressed at times.
Of course, Gary. And what the average employer must avoid doing is becoming a medical expert. You know, we must defer to the medical experts. You must not. The employer itself cannot determine whether an employee is depressed or not.
If an employee comes in with a certificate that says he's depressed, I mean, advice to your client, can you say, we'll send him to the company's psychiatrist.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. Who pays for that?
The company should pay for that. You know, right. If it's at the company's request, the company must pay for that.
Yeah.
That's always advisable to do. Mm. It gets more interesting, though, if the employee outrightly refuses to do that. Mm. You cannot force an employee to do it. However, you can... You can request, and there's also a section in the Employment Equity Act that provides a basis for you to do it. You know, it says if it's done with the consent, but if not, and if I can just grab the wording because it's nicely worded, and it provides quite a wide basis. If it is justifiable in the light of medical facts, employment conditions, social policy, etc.
What section are you reading from?
Section 7 from the Employment Equity Act, and it just says... Medical testing of an employee is prohibited unless the legislation permits or requires the testing, or it is justifiable. In the light of medical facts is one criteria.
Yeah.
Employment conditions, social policy, the fair distribution of employee benefits, or the inherent requirements of a job. So it's quite wide. There's quite a bit there to work with. And you can justify the medical testing, you know, or examination on that basis as well.
Mm. What we often do, just to add to Tasso, is we do often try to get the employee's consent to go and have a second opinion by the company's appointed doctor. And you know, that consent can be provided in an array of ways. You know, we always add a clause in employment contracts to say, you know, you have our consent to undergo medical testing as and when required by the company. So that's one way of doing it. Obviously, that is a blanket consent, so it's not the most ideal way. Mm. But, you know, if an employee is genuinely sick and you ask them to go for a second opinion, they, in our experience, you know, are more than willing to do that. You know, and then there is the option of you know, with some employers have the option of medical boarding, which, you know, is a mechanism to assist employees in, you know, as an alternative to their dismissal. So often they want to go on that second assessment. They want to get the medical boarding option. You know, that's not an option open to all employers. It really depends on whether they've got that insurance with a provider.
I guess your upfront contract with your employee is very important, and all this should be contained. If we ask you to go for a second opinion by our doctors, you will agree to do so. All that can be found there. Am I right?
100%, Gary. Yeah. 100%. And if I can just comment generally on what an employer should do, I mean, you've used the example of depression, but you know, whatever. Sometimes it's alcoholism or drug abuse.
Yes.
You know, an employer must investigate. It must investigate: is the illness temporary or permanent?
Mm.
It must investigate the nature of the illness. You know, how bad is it? And once that investigation has been done, the next step and what's required of an employee is to determine, can we accommodate this illness? And that's a massive thing that our courts look at, is you did the investigation, but you could have accommodated better. Mm. You know, can you reduce the working hours? Can you adapt? Can you demote the employee if it's required? Because, and I had a case, you know, that went to the CCMA and Labour Court again, and thankfully we won, where an employee, you know, had
it's
a car
funny,
accident.
Lawyers only tell you about the cases they win. Or do you only win your cases?
We do have a very good success rate.
Okay, cool. All right, good.
And in that case, the employee suffered a car accident, you know, on a weekend, and she suffered a brain injury. Mm. So you can appreciate that will affect, you know, a person's job, and it affected her cognitive ability to perform.
Mm.
So we had to really bend over backwards to accommodate that employee, and we did. Mm. We reduced her tasks. Eventually, she just couldn't perform the most menial of job, and we ultimately terminated her, and the dismissal was upheld.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting in that case is, to the RAF, the Road Accident Fund, she said, "I'm completely incapacitated."
Mm.
But when it came to her employer, who was trying to dismiss her for incapacity, she was like, "I'm perfectly fine."
Yeah. It was quite ironic. Yeah, and the commissioner picked up on that and criticized her for that.
You talk about alcoholism. Can you breathalyze one of your employees?
You can. And
or all of them, yeah.
I would recommend it. We actually have a client that breathalyzes all guests that attend the company, whether you're an employee or not. Before you enter the premises, they breathalyze you.
Oh, really?
So you can, and it's
who is this place? I don't want to go there.
I don't want to disclose that.
Okay, I understand.
But we have that, and there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. Again, it gets interesting if the employee outrightly refuses that. Yeah. You know, and how do you handle that? You can draw a negative inference from their refusal and go, but why? Why are you refusing? And just record that fact that on this day I requested that you be subjected to a breathalyzer test and you refused.
Last year I interviewed a guy called Angus MacArthur. He's a director of alcohol breathalyzers.
Wow.
And he said that the mines, he sells thousands of these breathalyzers, industrial breathalyzers, to the mines. They obviously breathalyze every one of the employees that comes in. Takes 6 seconds per person to breathalyze them. And if they fail, they're not allowed in. That's it. Mm. You can get a self-tester. I think it clicks for R700 if you want to test yourself.
Yes. Yeah. It's very interesting. You can understand why the mines do that. I mean, there's so much health and safety risks in those types of environments. So you need to ensure that your employees have their wits about them and aren't intoxicated in any way. And again, on the topic of alcohol and drug abuse, you know, there are two very different ways to deal with problems, and it depends on the circumstances of the case. You could have an employee like your Jolla, who I spoke about earlier, who comes in on a Monday morning and, you know, who's still intoxicated from the weekend. That guy needs to be dealt with in terms of misconduct. But if you've got an employee who, you know, goes for a swig of vodka in his car every half an hour, you know, that guy might have a genuine alcohol problem. He could be dependent on alcohol and or drugs. Mm. And then you need to to deal with that matter in terms of incapacity for ill health, which we've been talking about in this session.
Mm. Tasso, you want to add?
I just think generally, you know, reaching towards the end, Gary, there are remedies for employers, and they don't have to tolerate, you know, non-performing employees or incapacitated employees. It's just that our law does try to protect the employee in this scenario, and especially the vulnerable employee. So the employers must jump through a few hoops and a few hurdles, which is possible, but make sure you do that, because you don't want to be found at the CCMA, and as you said right at the beginning of the show, and get your ass whipped for not following procedure.
Yeah.
And just one last thing, when you are dealing with a malingering employee, it is very important to interrogate those medical certificates. As an HR practitioner, you must carefully scrutinize those, compare them with previous ones that you've received from that particular employee. Mm. Are they using the same doctor? Are they using different doctors each time? And we say that this is important because we very recently dealt with a case where an employee was booked off for a month. She was then scheduled to return back to work. She didn't. We interrogated this. She then suddenly sent through another medical certificate, and we noted that she had just simply changed the month. Her return back to work date, the month was changed. So we, on our client's behalf, we actually phoned that medical practitioner and said, Dr. X, we've got this medical certificate. Can you please just confirm that you, in fact, changed the month? And the doctor said, absolutely not. I haven't seen this employee since, you know, the month prior. And we actually charged that employee with fraud, and that employee was dismissed. You know, it is fraudulent to change a medical certificate on the face of it.
Yeah, I think you can buy these in Hillbrow, these fake medical certificates, very cheaply as well.
And just add something small to what Nadia has said, and we rely on this often. The Health Professions Council of South Africa has certain rules which it has published. And in terms of Rule 16 of those rules, there are certain requirements which every medical certificate or report must have. And it goes from A to J, and it's quite onerous. So you can test any medical certificate or report against this rule, which is quite helpful. We've relied on it a few times.
Good. Okay, anything else? What's your top five questions that you get from your clients, your HR practitioners, phoning you and saying, give me an idea of
A very common one, which has recently surfaced, is drugs and alcohol, for whatever reason. I mean, I've had a few cases where they've become alcoholics, but they start drinking at work. We had one case of an employee who, whenever he could, would go to his car and just take a bit of a sip of, you know, whatever alcohol
have
he was drinking.
Yeah.
So his case was quite bad, and we didn't treat that as a misconduct case. We treated it as an incapacity case because he suffered from alcohol.
Alcoholism.
So I've had a lot of drugs and alcohol. Mm. You know, queries a lot.
And I think the very reason why we've spoken on this topic of poor performance today is because it is very topical. You know, it might seem like something, you know, which is quite common, and it is indeed very common, but lots of employers don't know what are the hoops they need to jump through and how to jump through those hoops. Mm. So this comes up very, very, very often, poor performance.
Okay, good. We'd like to thank Evershed Sutherland, the multinational law firm, for lending us two of their top labor lawyers.
Thank you,
it's
Gary.
Nadia,
it was a pleasure.
Froneman with her cum laude LLB and Tasso Anastidis.
Not cum laude, but still got through.
Well, when a client phones you, they don't say, hello, do you have a cum laude?
Exactly.
They just say, can I get some advice from you? Evcharistopoli.
Parakalo.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to your firm. See you guys soon. Cheers for now.
Great, Gary. Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.